I want to thank Jason for teaching the class last week while I was away. I gave him, I think, 3 chapters worth of notes, and he didn't get that far, but that was kind of hopeful that he wouldn't get that far. That's a lot of material I handed to him. But we're in the middle of chapter 13, so I want to back up and do just some very quick reviewing. In chapter 12, it's almost like the book of Revelation starts over again. And chapter 12 is introducing us to some characters in very figurative, symbolic ways. We're introduced to the red dragon. Who is that?
Satan,
who is identified as Satan in verse 9 of that chapter. We're introduced to the woman. Who is she, figuratively? The faithful remnant, yes, who through whom the promised child was going to be born, whom the dragon was wanting to devour. He wanted to kill Satan. Satan wanted to kill Jesus. That's what this imagery is all about. And so when the dragon is not able to stop Jesus, and when he's not able to defeat the woman, which represents all of the faithful people of God, by the end of chapter 12, chapter 13 then introduces 2 allies that Satan is going to bring to bear to try to bring persecution against the children of the woman, the faithful people of God. So the first one is introduced in the first 10 verses of chapter 13, and it is called the beast from the sea. And what does the beast of the sea represent? This is what was covered last week.
The Roman,
Caesar's particularly, but certainly the Roman Empire is what is meant by the beast from the sea. That there were going to be political forces that were going to be brought to bear to persecute Christians. I have tried to present throughout this study that the timing of the writing of this book, I believe, was about 95 AD, and that through Nero and Domitian, as the emperors of Rome, there was a great persecution that was brought against the Christians. And that this particular letter is written to inform the Christians this is what's happening, God is aware of it, and that there is reason to be encouraged in the midst of this persecution. When we come to verse 11 of chapter 13, we see another beast coming up out of the sea, or out of the earth, and this beast is the false religions, the pagan religions that would be brought to bear in bringing a persecution against the Christians. They had some authority in the Roman Empire as a religious organization might in deciding on some regional councils and things, and they were using those to bring persecutions against the Christians. In verse 13, 14, 15, we see the kinds of things that this beast is doing, the pagan priest primarily. Verse 12 says he exercised all of the authority of the first beast. He is using the authority of the Roman Empire, the pagan priests were, to wield their persecution against the Christians. So they were working together, the Roman Empire and the pagan priest. And here they are presented as the two beasts from the sea and from the earth. We can certainly see in verse 13 that some signs were given to him. What were some of these signs? Do you recall? What were the signs intended to do? To deceive men, to make them believe of the lie that they were trying to promote. No, I think it's more like what we would call magic and deception. Perhaps sorcery, sleight of hand, trickery to convince people. It's where they would build a giant idol and they could make smoke come out of its ears or something like that, which in ancient times was amazing. You know, or it would be sleight of hand deceptions intended to deceive people so that they would believe the idol is real.
The reason I asked was because in 13 it says he performed great signs so that he even makes fire
Yes.
There's a.
Right. There's a lot of debate about exactly what that particular verse means. I tend to believe that they were somehow using science to call down lightning, a lightning rod or something like that, and they were saying that that was the sign of the God, something of that sort. It was not a miracle in the sense of the people of God performing miracles or a godly miracle. It wasn't something like that. It was a deception. That's what this is all about. He deceives those who dwell on the earth because of the signs that was given him to perform. They were convincing, but they were lies. That's what it says in verse 14. And so these signs were important, and if you study any of the pagan worship and the pagan idols and the things that were associated with them, you'll see some of that kind of deception in the way that they did business as a religion. Does that still happen today in religion? Yes. Go watch anything about Benny Hinn, and you'll see it. He is a false teacher extraordinaire with millions of followers who think he can do miracles. He cannot. That brings us to then the mark in verse 16. It says, he causes all, the small and the great and the rich and the poor and the free men and the slaves, to be given a mark on their right hand or on their forehead. And he provides that no one will be able to buy or to sell except the one who has the mark, either the name of the beast or the number of his name. Here is wisdom. Let him who has understanding calculate the number of the beast, for the number is that of a man, and his number is 666. Now, this is the portion of Revelation that everybody wants to go, what is that all about, right? I'm going to try to help you with it. The mark on the right hand or the forehead. Have we seen that before? There was a mark given to Cain on his forehead. But have we seen it in Revelation before? Everybody, do your head this way. Yeah, we did. It was in chapter 7, in verse 3, in chapter 9, in verse 4, chapter 14, in verse 1, where God had his mark on the faithful on their hand and on their forehead. This is the counterpart where Satan's going to put a mark on the forehead and the hand. Is this a literal mark? No, it's figurative. It represents that this person is identified as being with Satan. This person is identified as being with God. That's the imagery of the text. It is not literal in this sense. Okay? The mark was a requirement of all people without discrimination, it would say in this text, very much so. Just as God's mark is not literal, I have to believe this one is not either. Verse 17 says that in the Roman Empire, you weren't allowed to engage in commerce if you didn't have this mark. That's the important concept that helps us understand the symbolism of what's going on here. The Christian's character in his life would cause the world to boycott him. He would not bow to the image of the emperor. He would not bow and go into the houses of the idols. And so the result was going to be people wouldn't hire him. People would not do commerce with him. They wouldn't buy from him. They wouldn't sell to him. And he was kind of out on his own. That's what I believe this is talking about. Because those who were pagan didn't believe in one God. The Christian believed in one God. And particularly when the Gentiles became Christians, they suffered a lot of persecution like that amongst their own nationalities, where they found life very difficult because they chose to be a believer in Jesus Christ. There was no physical mark that was needed to identify who the Christian was and who the pagan was. You could tell by their behavior. You can tell by where they went and where they wouldn't go. So the opening of the third seal, a few chapters back, dealing with the black horse, signified a scarcity that would take place due to the discrimination that would come to the believers. And here this is confirming that concept in a very strong way. So all of the saints who refused to associate with emperor worship, even if they were threatened upon death, they were discriminated against. Hunger and starvation included in that. So then verse 18 talks about calculating the number of the beast. The number of the beast. The 666. There have been more mathematical calculations applied to the 666 than I can even name. Many, many, many dozens, where people have calculated it to be Hitler and Mussolini and anybody else in the current world or ancient world that was evil. They can't all be right, can they? If you use a Hebrew alphabet, many believe this refers to Emperor Nero of the Roman Empire. Using the same process in the Greek, it renders the number 105. There is all kinds of stuff associated with the 666. Some have even calculated it out to be the Pope. Numbers throughout the book of Revelation have been symbolic, haven't they? The 666 is symbolic. It is not a literal number. We've got to understand that. We've talked repeatedly in this class how the number 7 represents completeness or perfection. The number 6 represents a falling just short of completeness and perfection. And it seems to symbolize, the number 6 does, that everything that's human that's destined to fail. That seems to be the concepts in the number 6. The Jews in the first century consider the number 6 as an omen or a symbol of doom and dread, much like people today shy away from Friday the 13th or the 13th floor in the hotel. We have those same kind of stigmas attached to numbers. The Jews had that about the number 6. And so when 6 is tripled, the 666, it represents the completion of doom and failure, which is an appropriate mark for the servants of Satan. These are destined to doom. These are destined to eternal failure. That's the mark of the beast. The number, it says, is that of a man. The Greek in the language does not have an article before the word man. Even though most English translations do have an article, either the word a or the, I have to believe that there was no particular individual in mind. This is the mark of human. That this is the mark of mankind would be more the idea. So there are all kinds of modern-day premillennial applications of the 666, which would have had no meaning whatsoever to the original readers who needed encouragement in the first century. Premillennialism didn't come around until what period of time? Do you know? The concepts of premillennialism, false doctrine. 1950s. It's very recent, but it has been accepted very generically by a lot of people who call themselves Christians. That would have meant nothing to the people at this period of time. These people would only have been comforted by things, knowing about what was soon to take place in chapter 1 and verse 3, or chapter 22 and verse 6. This whole book is about something that's about to happen to them. I believe the 666 stands for the authority of the beast, the pagan idol priests, the beast of the sea, the beast of the earth. That this is what they represent. Those who are going to worship the false religion, what's going to happen to them eternally? Failure, loss, 666. That's the idea and the symbolism in this place. So wisdom teaches us that the beast will come to failure upon failure upon failure. That's what I see in the 666. Every individual then is going to have to choose either the mark of God or the mark of the beast. And there's nothing in between. We say it this way. I'm going to have to serve God to go to heaven, or I'm going to have to serve Satan and I'm going to go to hell. And there's nothing in between those two choices. That's the same way it's presented in this text, in the book of Revelation. The mark of God or the mark of the beast. There's nothing else. One of those two will be there. Jesus says in Matthew 6 and 24 that no one can serve two masters. And that's exactly right. thoughts, questions, or comments then about the end of chapter 13? That was pretty quick. I know it was. Okay. Feel free to come back to me on that. Chapter 14 then. He says, "Then I looked, and behold, the Lamb was standing on Mount Zion, and with him 144,000, having his name and the name of his Father written on their foreheads. And I heard a voice from heaven like the sound of many waters, and like the sound of loud thunder, and the voice which I heard was like the sound of harpists playing on their harps. And they sang a new song before the throne and before the four living creatures and the elders. And no one could learn the song except the 144,000 who had been purchased from the earth. These are the ones who have not been defiled with women, for they have kept themselves chaste. These are the ones who follow the Lamb wherever he goes. These have been purchased from among men as first fruits to God and to the Lamb. And no lie was found in their mouth. They are blameless." Now, if you have been joining me in this class for the last several weeks, there should have been a number of images and figurative language in those five or six verses that just jumped off the page at you that meant something. So let's see, as reviewing, how many of those you got. Verse 1, what does the Lamb represent? Jesus Christ. You see that in chapter 5. He is the Lamb standing as if slain. The Lamb is Jesus Christ. Who are the 144,000? Those are the saints of God. It's 12 times 12 times 12, 12 being the sign of the number for the people of God. Is it a literal number or is it figurative? It's figurative. There's not a literal 144,000 that are going to be saved, as some want to teach today. This is a figurative number. In verse 2, he hears the voice from heaven. Have we seen descriptions like that before of what the voice sounds like? Yes. And who is the voice usually that's speaking like that? It's usually God. Sometimes it's presented as an angel who has the authority of God and has similar language attached to it. Thunder, lightning, earthquakes, all of those kinds of things. They sang a new song. Have we had a new song before? Yes, we did. I believe it was just a couple of chapters back, in chapter 10 or so, if I'm not mistaken. The new song that they're singing here is before the throne. Where's the throne? This is the heavenly throne of God as presented in chapter 4. And he's before the four living creatures. What are the four living creatures? They're described in the throne scene in chapter 4. They are some sort of spiritual being. They are servants of God. They come out in force in a few places in the book as introducing others that are coming from the throne of God. They are creatures of the spiritual realm that serve the Lord. And so he says no one could learn the new song except the 144,000 who had been purchased from the earth. From the earth. I have to believe that these are the ones who were the faithful ones of God. They had been purchased by the blood of the Lamb, right? If you're a student of the New Testament, that should make perfect sense. They had been purchased, and their freedom had been granted by their forgiveness through Jesus Christ. And we know that that's the case because they're described a little bit in verse 4. We see they had kept themselves chaste, the text would tell us. I believe this is not physical, but spiritual. They were refusing to bow down to the idol. They kept themselves spiritually chaste. They were reserved for the one true God. They were not going to be a spiritual harlot and serve the idol or try to. Throughout the Old Testament, don't we see language like that, though, where Israel has committed spiritual adultery and harlotry as they have bowed down to the idols, as they also tried to worship God? These didn't do that. They were spiritually chaste, if you will. In 2 Corinthians 11 and verse 2, Paul writes, I am jealous for you with a godly jealousy, for I betrothed you to one husband so that to Christ I might present you as a pure virgin. There's that same spiritual sense of this same kind of language spoken of as us as Christians. These, of the 144,000, are those who follow the Lamb. Who's the Lamb? Jesus Christ. They are the servants of Christ. That's not so difficult to see. They continue to abide and walk in the Lord. It's not that they obeyed the gospel and fell away, but they are staying steady and strong and true in following Christ. They were purchased from among men as first fruits to God and the Lamb. Under the old law, which I think is some of the imagery here, the first fruits were offered to God, as required by the law, as an acknowledgement that all the land and all of its increase belonged to God. These were offered, these people were first fruits to God. Paul does apply the first fruits to Christian converts in Asia and Achaia in Romans and 1 Corinthians. James 1 and verse 8 speaks of those who have been brought forth by the word of truth as a kind of first fruits of his creatures. We see the same kind of imagery in other places in the New Testament. This is not unique to Revelation. I think the first fruits in this context must refer to the 144,000. That's got to be what it's referring to. So it also points to others who would come after them, who would likewise be devoted to God. They would be the first fruits, if you will, belonging to Him. These were blameless. There was no there was no lie found in their mouth, no religious falsehood. They didn't serve the idols. They didn't pretend to serve the idols. They were not bowing down to the Caesar. They served the Lord, and they did not deny that Jesus was their Lord. They were blameless, the text would tell us, meaning there was no spiritual or moral blemish within them. The church is supposed to be holy and blameless, Ephesians 4 and verse 27 tells us. And Peter tells us in 2 Peter 3 and verse 14 that we're supposed to be diligent to be found in Him. How's it finish? Spotless and blameless. That's how we're supposed to be found when Christ returns. That's what we want. So this language, while it is in this figurative context, should not be very surprising or all that difficult for us to see that the 144,000 who are learning this new song, it's talking about the faithful saints of God. I have to believe that's the context here. Thoughts or comments through verse 5? Okay, let's look at verse 6. We're now going to be introduced to three angels that are presented. He says, I saw another angel flying in mid-heaven, having an eternal gospel to preach to those who live on the earth and to every nation and tribe and tongue and people. And he said with a loud voice, fear God and give Him glory, because the hour of His judgment has come. Worship Him who made the heaven and the earth and the sea and springs of water. And another angel, a second one, followed, saying, fallen, fallen is Babylon the great, she who has made all the nations drink of the wine of the passion of her immorality. Then another angel, a third one, followed them, saying with a loud voice, if anyone worships the beast in his image and receives a mark on his forehead or on his hand, he also will drink of the wine of the wrath of God, which is mixed in full strength in the cup of his anger. And he will be tormented with fire and brimstone in the presence of the holy angels and in the presence of the Lamb. And the smoke of their torment goes up forever and ever. They have no rest day and night, those who worship the beast in his image and whoever receives the mark of his name. Here is the perseverance of the saints who keep the commandments of God and their faith in Jesus. And I heard a voice from heaven saying, write, blessed are the dead who die in the Lord from now on. Yes, says the Spirit, so that they may rest from their labors, for their deeds follow with them. Now, some of us are probably somewhat familiar with verse 13. We've heard that verse referenced many times, and maybe even a lesson brought from that concept. But we might not always connect it to the context in this chapter. So the three angels are presented. Where is the first angel? Where is he told us that he is at? Flying in the mid-heaven. What would be the mid-heaven? In the midst of heaven. John's seeing a vision, right? It's not real. Most of us say this is a sci-fi vision. There's a lot of weirdness in it. It's the mid-heaven. It's not in the heaven way up high where we might see God is at, or the stars and the moons, but something in the mid-heavens is all that this is saying. I don't think it's a literal place that's being described to us, the mid-heavens. The Greek word indicates the point where the sun has reached the meridian, the highest point in the heavens. Thayer indicates that he believes that this is a reference to noon. Maybe. I'm not sure of that. But from the point where this angel is at, whatever that is, he can be seen and he can be heard throughout the entire earth. Now that's obviously figurative, yes? Wherever he's at in the sky, mid-heaven, everybody on the planet's going to be able to see him. This is obviously figurative. He has this eternal gospel to preach to those who are on the earth. The eternal gospel will go to whom? What's the text say? What's the message? Who does the message go to? Everyone, right? Doesn't that sound like the gospel message we read about in the New Testament, that there's no difference between Jew or Gentile or slave or free or male or female, that we're all one in Christ Jesus? Absolutely, that's the same kind of language. This is the gospel message that he's speaking of. What does the word gospel mean? Good news. That's what it means, good news. This is the only occurrence of the word gospel in all of the writings of John. You don't see it anywhere else except right here. And I have to believe that that was intentional, that this would be a striking point when he uses the word gospel. This is not some new message, but it's the eternal good news that has been first proclaimed by Jesus Christ, preached to all nations, the message that was put into earthen vessels. This angel seems to represent God's servants, the saints, who would be preaching the gospel in all generations, is what I believe. Verse 7 says a little bit about the message of the gospel. Fear God and give him glory, because the hour of his judgment has come. Worship the Creator. The gospel is calling all men to respect and to revere God and to give him glory in their acceptance of his good news when we obey him. 1 Peter 4 and 11 echoes this sentiment. 1 Peter 4, 11, in all things God may be glorified through Jesus Christ, to whom belongs the glory and dominion forever and ever. And so God's coming judgment, which is what we still point to, the end judgment, God's coming judgment, which was more immediate in the first century, this judgment that was going to come upon the Roman Empire and upon the pagan religions, this judgment that was coming should cause men to repent and to begin to serve God. I have to believe this is the more immediate punishment that's being spoken of because of the second angel. What's the message of the second angel? Fallen, fallen is Babylon. Has Babylon fallen yet? At the time that this was written? As you're reading through the book? Babylon has not yet fallen. So why does it say fallen, fallen is Babylon? When God decrees that something's going to happen, you can just say it's happened. And that's how they do it. Particularly in the book of Revelation. It is decreed that it has happened before it does, because God says this is going to happen. Fallen, fallen is Babylon the Great. You're not going to see that happen until chapter, I think it's 18, is where Babylon actually falls. So it could be, you might want to see this as prophecy, but I think he's just trying to indicate that God has decreed that this is going to happen, just like this judgment is going to come. The judgment is the fall of Babylon the Great. That, it's one and the same. Yes, sir? Generally, when we hear the concept of Babylon, yes, I would agree that it's more of the Roman government being fallen. This is the first time that Babylon is introduced in this place, God's judgment upon this great city. Is it literally Babylon? No, it's figurative. It's not the literal city. The first angel had warned of this. It is now occurred when God has decreed it. And every time Babylon is named in the book of Revelation, it is always called great. You can see it in chapter 14, 16, 17, 18, three times in chapter 18. It's either called great or is the great city, which you can see in chapter 11 and in verse 8, the great city. Babylon is later identified as Rome, named as Rome. And so this is one of those other images in the book of Revelation that is actually described. Just like the red dragon is identified as Satan, Babylon is going to be identified by God. This is what's going to happen. So the nation who has made all the nations drink of the wine and the passion of her immorality are going to be judged. What was the immorality of Babylon? In this context, I have to believe it's a spiritual immorality, that they promoted idolatry, they promoted the worship of a man, Caesar, and they caused people to not serve God. In fact, they decreed that you must serve the emperor as a god. You must bow to the local deities, but they took away from Jehovah in doing that. And so that's the immorality that I think is being discussed here. It's more of the spiritual immorality that's being spoken of. God has called them to repentance in verses 6 and 7. But they don't listen. And so they're doomed because the wrath of God is about to be poured out upon them. That's the message of this point of the text. What's the warning then of the third angel in verse 9? If you're not going to serve God, you're going to get all of God's wrath. And I mean, you're going to get all of it. That's the message here. And it's very, very plain that this wrath, the wine of the wrath of God, it's figurative, but this wrath of God is to anyone who worships the beast and his image. Who is the beast? Who's the beast? I'd have to point to probably the latter part of chapter 13, speaking of the idolatrous religions, or perhaps the beast at the beginning of chapter 14, which is the worship of the Caesars through the Roman Empire. It would have to be one of those two, I have to believe, is what's being described here. Anyone who would receive that mark on their forehead or hand, verse 17, would seem to point more toward the second beast as being what's still being described. And so this is proclaimed by this third angel, in hopes of deterring some from the false worship, that they might turn to God. Verse 9 says that God's wine of wrath is mixed in the full strength of his anger. His wrath is mixed in the full strength of his anger. They have to drink it. They will be forced to drink it. It is God's judgment. They're not going to have a choice about that. We see some similar imagery to this in the book of Jeremiah, in chapter 25 in verse 15, where God says to a foreign nation, "Take this cup of mine, take this cup of wine of wrath from my hand and cause all the nations to whom I send you to drink it." Very similar image. So to the people who knew the old law, when they got to this portion of the text, that wouldn't have been so drastically a difficult image to see, that it's symbolic of them being forced to drink of this judgment. Now, in my studies, it seems that the ancients supposedly drank wine frequently, mixed with spices and diluted with water. That's how they usually drank wine. So when they wanted a different flavor, they would mix the spices a little differently. God's wine of his wrath will not be diluted. That's the message here. It will be mixed full strength in the cup of his anger. there's no holding back from God, is the message here. He's going to torment with fire and brimstone in the presence of the angels and the Lamb, and the smoke of their torment will be eternal. The judgment is what he's speaking of. They're not going to have any rest from this judgment. Again, some similar language can be found in Isaiah 34, and beginning in verse 9, where God pours out his judgment on the nation of Edom. And he says, "The Lord has a day of vengeance, a year of recompense for the cause of Zion. Its streams will be turned into pitch, and its loose earth into brimstone, and its land will become burning pitch. It will not be quenched night or day. Its smoke will go up forever." Similar kind of concepts is what we're seeing in the message of this third angel. So the angels who had watched all this unfolding of God's eternal purpose with mankind, who had seen the conflicts between good and evil, who are now seeing the consummation of that purpose and the final consequences of evil, are the ones who are announcing the eternal torment for those who have rejected the gospel of Jesus Christ. And that is very much the New Testament message. No change there. What is the blessing then that's pronounced from heaven in verse 13? Blessed are the dead who die in the Lord from now on. This is not just about them, but it's about us, right? Now, why would that message be placed right here to the readers in the first century or the beginning of the second century? True. Christians were about to start dying under the persecutions. Blessed are those who die in the Lord. You stay faithful. You don't bow to the idols. You don't bow to Caesar. You don't walk away from the faith. You don't waver in your faith. You serve God all the way to death, and he will bless you. That's the message. It's a message of comfort in the midst of great persecution. They could see the persecution. They could see it coming and getting more intense. They could see that some were going to be put to death. Has God forgotten us? Would have to be the thinking. No, God says he's going to bless you, but the persecution's going to happen. Remember that John was required to eat a little book a few chapters back? What was said about that book when he ate it? It'd be sweet to eat and bitter in his stomach. This message is the bitterness. Many of the Christians are going to die. That's not going to stop. God's not going to stop that yet. There's going to be this great persecution and Christians are going to die. The faithful in the Lord are going to struggle in this persecution. So here is the perseverance of the saints who keep the commandments of God and their faith in Jesus. Verse 12. The dragon in chapter 12 was going off to make war with those who keep the commandments of God and hold to the testimony of Jesus, chapter 12 and verse 17. And now we're told those were going to die, many of them. Satan was making war. Some were going to die in that war. That's the message of the book. The perseverance, or the patience in the King James, the perseverance of the saints was accepting death or captivity because of their faith. And so the opposition of the beast demanded this trial that would have to be endured. We think we have some things that are bad in our country that we have to put up with and endure. It doesn't compare to what was going on at the turn of the 200s AD. Not at all. What does it mean to die in the Lord? That you're faithful. At the point of death, you have not denied Christ. You have not turned away from serving God to pursue the idols or the emperor worship. And those kinds of concepts, is certainly the context here. They were in the Lord. Does that sound similar to the concepts in the New Testament about being in Christ? I have to think that it is. Ephesians 1 and verse 3 says that all spiritual blessings are in Christ Jesus. And it's the same concept, whether you're looking at it in this figurative letter or in the literal sense in other places. Yes, that they may rest from their labors, for their deeds follow after them. John has been told in chapter 6, beginning in verse 9, that the martyrs underneath the altar of God were at rest, and that those coming out of this great tribulation were before the throne serving God day and night in chapter 7. And the word of encouragement is, blessed are the dead who die in the Lord from now on. It's that's the part of the book, of the message of this third angel, that was very important. The assurances, though, are not just for that time frame. It works for us as well. We need to be those who are faithful unto death. Thoughts or comments through verse 13? It's a strong blow to many false doctrines, but Calvinism, yes, very much so. Because Calvinism would say that once you're saved, you're always saved. And no, be faithful unto death. You cannot fall away and be saved. That's the whole point here. Verse 14 then says, I looked, and behold, a white cloud. And sitting on the cloud was one like a son of man, having a golden crown on his head and a sharp sickle in his hand. And another angel came out of the temple, crying out with a loud voice to him who sat on the cloud, put in your sickle and reap, for the hour to reap has come, because the harvest of the earth is ripe. Then he who sat on the cloud swung his sickle over the earth, and the earth was reaped. Who is portrayed as the reaper? Who does the reaper represent? I have to believe it's Jesus. One, like a son of man. That's the key. Jesus was, he calls himself the son of man in a few places. And including in John's gospel, he's referred to as the son of man several times. And so we have to understand that sitting on the white cloud, the crown of glory, many symbols that we've already seen indicating divinity and God. I have to believe this is about Jesus Christ. An angel comes out saying, put in your sickle to reap. The angel is making the announcement for the Father. This is the message from God. God's appointed hour has been proclaimed. It is God's timing. The announcement having come from the temple. And so the harvest is ripe. The Greek word that is rendered ripe in this place literally means withered away. It's translated withered away 11 times. It means dried up 3 times. It's translated that way. And in this instance, it is rendered ripe. It indicates a period of time when the season of growth has ended, that the plants have dried up, it's time to clear the field. It's ripe. That's not what we think of as ripe, but that's what the image is here. So imagine in the heyday of the Roman Empire, it had risen up to this great empire, and God says, that's it. It's time to reap it and pull it down. It's not going to grow anymore. It's God's timing, that the judgment is going to come on this great and strong nation of mankind. It's a wicked nation. But he's going to put it to an end. And the bell just rang. So next week we're going to have to start with verse 17. We will most likely conclude all the way through the end of chapter 16 next week. I would encourage you to do some reading. I certainly appreciate your attention and comments through this class. Thank you so much.